Numerous reports indicate that manufacturing has emerged as the favorite target of ransomware groups and hackers. In response, a new report from Industrial Media discusses the evolution of industrial cybersecurity, its current state, and the tactics hackers are using, including phishing schemes, malware, and ransomware attacks. It also details solutions and arming manufacturers with the knowledge and resources needed to win more fights on this highly complex and ultra-competitive battlefield. Download the industrial sector's new battlefield by going to manufacturing.net/cyber. Hi, I'm Jeff Ranke, Editorial Director of Manufacturing.net and Manufacturing Business Technology. Welcome to Security Breach. When it comes to the industrial sector's ongoing cybersecurity challenges, we are, without a doubt, our own worst enemy. Of course, this doesn't stem from an overwhelming desire to self-sabotage, but from the rapid pace of ever-evolving demands that can only be met by realizing the competitive benefits of speed, efficiency, and cost controls, and the related technological investments needed to make them a reality. And recently, these production dynamics are being implemented at a rate compliant with technological capabilities, but failing to account for the implementation of cybersecurity protocols on the same scale. In other words, we have more to defend, and we're not responding quickly enough. In case you needed proof, listen to some of the recent stats in Drago's 2023 Year in Review report. It found that 80% of industrial sector vulnerabilities reside deep within the ICS network, making it difficult to see and harder to kick out. 53% of the advisories Drago's analyzed could cause both a loss of visibility and control. Ransomware attacks against industrial organizations increased by 50% last year, and Drago's tracked 28% more ransomware groups focused on the ICS and OT environments. Attacks were confirmed in 33 unique manufacturing sectors, and 74% of all vulnerability advisories had no mitigation strategy. Finally, 51% of manufacturers are struggling with segmentation. I'm not going to promise solutions for all of these challenges, but we've definitely found a guy interested in trying. It's my pleasure to welcome Scott Saris to the show. He's an information security, compliance, and privacy solutions advisor at Aprio, a leading advisory and business consulting firm. Scott, thanks so much for joining us today, and welcome to Security Breach. So jumping right in, Scott, you know, one of the big things that when we talk about the OT environment is just how much the threat landscape is growing. As we add more of these connections and more IoT devices and all that good stuff, we leave ourselves open to more attacks and more vulnerabilities that can pop up. Is there anything that you're seeing specifically in terms of sort of a hotspot in terms of new vulnerabilities or new things that are being exploited?
Well, I think that the OT environment, the operational technology environment, should really be called old technology. Many of the vulnerabilities that we're seeing out there stem from things we've dealt with in the past on a regular basis. A failure to update software and patch systems on a good cycle means that we have vulnerable systems in our environments. Weak authentication controls tends to be another hot spot out there from a vulnerability perspective. Insecure protocols as well maintain a big surface area for attack of OT systems. So those three tend to be the top attack vectors that we see out there from an OT perspective.
So what have been some of the things that you've seen trying to either mainly strategies, I guess, to try to reinforce some of these things? Because like you mentioned, it's pretty basic stuff. It feels like the blocking and tackling, so to speak. Have you seen any approaches or strategies that have been implemented successfully to try to sort of negate some of these issues?
Well, I think that any number of organizations, be it CIS, be it SANS, be it NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, provide great guidance in terms of frameworks to apply to these environments. I'm particularly fond of NIST CSF, which provides at a high level a strategy for implementation of security controls within these environments, starting at the identification cycle. Of knowing what we have in these environments is critical. for handling security within the environment. Then, of course, you move to the protect phase, which establishes the security controls, detect, which establishes monitoring, and then respond and recover to address those things that are successful in breaching security. So from a security perspective, I think I'd point organizations to establish standards that really drive home the security controls that are appropriate for their environment.
You know, Scott, I'd kind of like to maybe point to your experience. You've been doing this industrial cybersecurity thing for a little bit here, and it seems to me like it always comes back to the people factor. We can talk about frameworks and standards, but at the same time, it really rely on those people on the plant floor to embrace the double-factor authentication or making sure we're not plugging in foreign devices and things like that. What have you seen, or is there something out there that we can be doing better to help people really embrace the role that they play in cybersecurity, especially now, maybe more than ever?
Yeah, absolutely. The human element should never be overlooked, right? The fact of the matter is that's where most of the attacks are occurring today. We see AI accelerating that attack on the human firewall. Correct. Awareness training for the end users is vital. One mistake by one user can have a dramatic impact to the organization. And no matter how much we spend on technology, that human can often be the source of a successful attack. But I also don't want to ignore the risk associated with failing to properly train and make aware your IT professionals, your OT professionals, your security personnel, your administrators on what your expectations are for the protection of systems and data within your environment. That starts at good policies and good standards, but it also extends into properly training those individuals to adhere to those standards and ensuring that they're not through need to bypass security doing the wrong things.
In manufacturing, we've long had this weird silo where the IT is here and the OT is here and they don't like working together. Is this bringing them together a little bit more? Are we getting better at breaking down some of those silos, or is it still a big challenge?
Well, you know, it's an interesting problem, more at the political layer and more in many organizations, right? But the fact of the matter is, we're going to sink or swim as a business, as a whole. Many of the attacks that are occurring on OT technology stem from the IT side of the organization. Last numbers I was looking at was in the 70% range, right? And that's because IT supports many of the core infrastructures that OT relies on, be that network communications, be that internet, remote access control, authentication, and so on. So we have a reliance on core IT structures. So as a result, and we are forced in some cases to trust those structures. I think it's important for us to realize that we're going to succeed as a whole in bringing the OT and the IT side together to address the security needs of OT is important.
So I'm going to put you on the spot here a little bit. Hopefully this doesn't get you in too much trouble, but we've got this growing OT landscape. We're adding more connections, more devices, more technology. As that expands, who is responsible, in your opinion? Is this up to the OT folks to be talking to IT and say, hey, we got more stuff we need to keep safe? Is it up to IT to come to OT and say, look, we see you're growing. We've got these tools that you're going to need to morph, not cut and paste, but sort of implement however necessary, and that dialogue takes place? But who needs to make that first step, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Well, I'm not sure that there is a good answer for that. A lot of it's going to depend on the organization, right, Jeff? We have to tear down barriers. CISOs that operate in organizations that have a separate operational arm need to treat that operational arm as a core business unit, just as we would any other side of the business. We need to understand what their mission statement is, how their strategy evolves, what their goals and objectives are, and drive a security model that makes sense for the protection of the critical assets. In many cases, these assets are supporting critical business functions or things that make money for the organization. Let's be honest, we need to treat those with the respect that they're due and ensure that they're prioritized for protection.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I want to kind of, again, lean on some of your experience here in the industrial sector. I know you've worked with a lot of different manufacturers of different sizes. What we saw for a while is those smaller manufacturers were definitely lagging behind in some of their technology investments. During the pandemic, they seem to have caught up and made a lot of different purchases associated with automation and Industry 4.0 and things of that nature, but not necessarily on the cybersecurity side. It seems like they're still lagging there. And a lot of times this stems from the fact that they don't feel they're on the radar screen of hackers. They don't feel like they're a target. We've seen this thought process negated numerous times over the last couple of years. But what can you tell us a little bit, maybe helping some of those smaller manufacturers to realize, hey, you are a target, you are on the radar screen, and you play a pivotal role, because if you're hit, it's going to attack a lot of people down the line as well.
Yeah, understand that a lot of organizations today take that that position. In some respects, we've done organizations a disservice by continually screaming that they're going to be attacked, they're going to be attacked, they're going to be attacked. We need to take a very rational view to addressing risk within the organization, make sure that we're not screaming, being a chicken little, if you'd prefer, as we engage with these organizations. Instead, we need to be the consultant to the business to adequately represent what the true risk is in our environment and address those risks. We deal well with normalcy bias, right? Even when there is a disaster or a major problem at organization, people ignore it because we've trained them to ignore it by continually screaming that there's a problem, there's a problem, there's a problem. So I think that part of this problem is due to how we've addressed risk with an organization. But you know, when we look at things like ransomware today, ransomware is probably our biggest risk to most organizations. We're not necessarily dealing with the same risks in OT that we are in IT. In many respects, IT, we're focused at protecting the data of the organization. In OT, we have a different mission statement, right? Oftentimes, we're talking about systems that are critical to the business for the automation within manufacturing, distribution, medical, whatever the space is. And many of these have life safety impacts. And as a result, we have to look at ransomware differently in this space than, for example, we would in the IT space. They're interested in extorting money from you. It's that simple. And because the impacts to you as an organization, particularly in the OT space, supporting these mission critical operations is so much higher and has so much greater impact, that form of attack, that form of extortion can be very, very valuable to them. So in many respects, that's why you're seeing a huge increase in interest in OT space because of the industries that it's supporting, and the mission critical nature of the business, the life safety impacts that are a consideration. So they're focused on you. And if you think it's not going to happen, trust me, it can happen. Our goal from a security perspective is to lower the risk of that affecting you. And if it does affect you, to control the impact through a careful plan, respond, recover mechanism that allows you to contain that impact to the extent possible.
No, I love the way you phrased that too. And talking about the risk, I think when you're absolutely right. I think when you start talking about cyber attacks and ransomware attacks and everything else, it can be very overwhelming for a lot of organizations, and they end up putting their head in the sand a little bit. Looking at it from a risk perspective, what is at risk and identifying that, and then talking about mitigation strategies or response strategies is a big part of that. It makes it more, I think, palatable to organization regardless of the size. I think that's an important part of the messaging, absolutely.
I absolutely believe it is. I think I read an article last year by Poneman Institute. Larry and his team kind of determined what are the things that help control a breach, and having a good cybersecurity incident response program in place, one that's established, and you require your professionals in your organization, your IT, OT professionals, to work together to identify, to contain, to respond, and as importantly, to recover from that incident, which should also include a good communication and crisis management plan, was one of the key indicators of success and help to lower the impact of a breach for an organization.
Absolutely. Well, we've talked a lot about the challenges and the messaging and things of that nature. Maybe now you can tell us a little bit more about specifically what Aprio does to help with sort of the industrial cybersecurity dynamic.
Yeah, absolutely. Aprio is well-versed in evaluating organizations' security. We believe in a risk-based approach, one that establishes those things that the organization should be concerned about from a security perspective. I think one of the easiest ways to fail from a security perspective is to try to do everything at once. So for us, we take a risk-based approach, one that says, here's the things we're worried about from a security perspective. Today, of course, ransomware has to be one of those. But we develop a risk portfolio for the organization, one that establishes the things we're worried about. Then we address cybersecurity from a controls perspective. You know, controls exist to affect risk in a positive fashion, right? We're not doing these things because they exist for no reason. We're doing them to control those risks that we're worried about. And many of those are process oriented. So how well we execute that process is really, really important to containing the risk associated with that control. So for us, we look at maturity models and determine how well an organization is executing cybersecurity and key areas. Then we map the two together. For us, it allows us to establish a strategy for the organization, one that is focused on the key risks and those controls that will have the best impact to those risks that the organization is likely to affect.
Absolutely. So I want to circle back on a couple of things there, Scott. One of the things you mentioned earlier on was patching. And we've talked about risk mitigation and identifying where those risks are. I think a lot of the bigger technology companies, especially in the industrial sector, have gotten a lot better at identifying these vulnerabilities and providing patches for them. The problem we have is when we get into a manufacturing setting, they don't want to slow down. They don't want to stop lines. Implementing these patches becomes very difficult and very challenging. What is your takeaway there in terms of maybe helping us figure out a better way to install these patches? Or is there some sort of process that we could implement that you've seen that might help?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of different standards out there to address vulnerability testing and remediation and patching as a result of that, right? Typically, when we run vulnerability scanning, we're going to identify two major areas of risk that come out of that sort of testing. One is going to be those patches. What are we doing from a patch perspective to update the software and remove vulnerabilities that may be present in the code or systems themselves? The second is misconfigurations, right? Oftentimes we see systems put into place that have vulnerabilities just by the nature of how we implemented those systems. How many times have you heard the implementation team say, yeah, we're going to set it up this way with a default password just to get it running. And then 5 years later, you find out that that default password was left in place. So vulnerability testing systems give us the ability to identify both sides of that equation. how bad the problems we created when we implemented the system, as well as those patches that are missing. And the key to success in this is, again, going to a risk-based approach to dealing with those misconfigurations and those missing patches for these systems. NIST, SP 140, and other standards that are out there all start with a classification mechanism. CVSS and others provide great guidance on how much risk is inherent in the misconfiguration or the vulnerabilities that are present in the patches that are out there. Classifying those as, for example, critical, high, medium, low, and then providing the standard by which executive and senior management in the organization expects those vulnerabilities to be resolved is important. And it's important because then we go to that next step, which is to drive reporting of those critical vulnerabilities and misconfigurations to management so we can establish what their expectations are and whether they're being met or not met and why we're not meeting those. If our expectation is a critical vulnerability needs to be remediated within 7 days, and I've got a critical vulnerability out there for 30 days, as a senior manager, as a CISO or an executive in the organization, I want to know why that's not occurring. And if it's because production schedules or other business requirements are necessitating that, then I need to make that decision. What you don't want is you don't want your junior members of staff running vulnerability testing and remediation to be forced in the position of accepting risk on behalf of the organization. If the senior members, CISO and above, want to accept the risk of critical vulnerabilities for 30 days because they're balancing the needs of the business and the other risks to the business as a result, that's fine, but that needs to be a noted decision. It needs to be cataloged. We need to understand why that decision was made. So force that reporting, force that decision to the business, and for the guys that are in the trenches, that will ensure that you get the downtime that you need to address the issue. And if not, you're not in the position of accepting the risk on behalf of the corporation.
No, well said. And Scott, I love how you keep taking this back to sort of the fundamental foundational layer of a lot of these protocols and a lot of these approaches. I think that's so important because, again, in manufacturing, we want to go. We want to move as opposed to maybe just taking a heartbeat to slow it down, not stop it, slow it down for a second and really look at the right process that we need to implement all these things and not just focusing on, I need to put this tool here and this patch there. Let's make sure we do it right from the foundation, from the start. I think that's so critical.
Absolutely. And when we look at the implementation schemas for many organizations, high speed, low drag has been the mantra for many of these organizations. I think we need to take a step back and see if the guidance that we provide to our IT and OT professionals in terms of policies and standards that are dictated to them on how we should be operating things like implementations and configurations and so on can be adequately followed given the time and the resources provided to them to accomplish the tasks that are inherent to those models.
High speed, low drag. You're taking me back to my time as an infantryman here. I haven't heard that one for a little bit. You know, and a lot of stuff you just talked about there, Scott, it feels to me like those are cultural dynamics. And I think that the industrial sector has had a bit of a cultural revolution in that they're appreciating the fact that these cybersecurity concerns, they're not just IT, they're not just the CIO. It needs to be embraced throughout the organization. Have you seen sort of a, come to the light sort of moment over the last couple of years within the industrial sector where they are embracing this more as a bigger picture concern?
Well, I think in many respects, we're being forced to do that, right? From an OT perspective, IT started to address changes in their security model pre-COVID, right? As many of their applications and systems were migrating from on-premise to on cloud technologies to SaaS and so on, we started to move a great number of our resources in IT outside the boundaries, the walls of our organization. The shift in COVID had now all of our endpoints picked up and moved as people were working from home a great deal more. All of a sudden, the boundaries and everything that we created in an IT side to protect those assets that were on-premise computers and systems were all now essentially obsolete. So our security model has to shift and change as well. You saw a great deal of discussion with authentication being the new the new boundary for the organization. In many respects, we're seeing the paradigm within OT take the same shift. Now, OT tends to move slower because we tend to put in OT systems for the long term. It's not unusual to see 10 plus year life cycles for OT technology. So a lot of organizations take the COVID pause as an opportunity to do some refresh. And I think what's become apparent out of that is that we've turned the old Purdue model on its head as well. Kind of the on-premise boundary models that are defined within Purdue are a lot less viable. So we have to adjust the architectural approaches for these organizations, find the isolation models that we can implement as OT starts to then shift to a broader digital footprint for greater communications into these environments with 5G and other technologies driving into the space, as well as, of course, the cloud-based services that are being offered and driven into the environment.
Well, and that's a great point too, Scott. I mean, when we look at these frameworks, people look at them as very rigid, and the reality is no situation is the same. This is an over-the-counter type of approach. We can be flexible in terms of the things that we want to implement here. These are guidelines. These are things to help organization put together a framework, not necessarily feeling locked in specifically to what's being specified here, right?
Yeah, I think that's an important note, and I'm glad you bring that up. These are guidelines. This is a checklist of all the good things you should be doing from a security perspective within your organization. But it's not necessarily a one size fits all. There are pieces and parts of every standard, and whether I'm following ISO, whether I'm following one of the NIST standards, NIST SP 853 and in critical infrastructure, for example, CSF and a lot more of the commercial environments, whether I'm talking some of the HIPAA stuff, I'm talking whatever I'm talking from a framework perspective, it has to be intelligently applied. Yeah. And I think that key to that is the interpretation of the control, understanding what the intent of that control is, and where it doesn't apply, carefully noting that and denoting where the how you address that the key requirements, the intent of that control through other mechanisms. For example, the enforcement of boundaries using L3 or L7 firewall technologies is always a really great discussion. A lot of times we don't have that ability in OT environments, and we're relegated to network access control mechanisms or isolation models using VLANs, private VLANs, and so on. But you have to understand the intent of the control. What am I trying to get out of it? What risk am I trying to abate? And what's my mechanism for doing that? And I think that that's an important point to note. And a lot of that's driven by architecture, right? The overall components and pieces in their organization within the environment and how those are applied.
So talking about proper application and the correct intent, this just immediately took my brain down something that I'm sure you may be, maybe over with talking about. But when we talk about cybersecurity and really manufacturing, we talk a ton about artificial intelligence right now and the impact that it's having. I think, again, it's sort of misconstrued in a lot of applications and a lot of worrying and hand-wringing that goes on when we bring the topic up. But I'd really like to get your take on it. When you think about artificial intelligence in this environment, what does it mean to you?
Yeah, I think that artificial intelligence can be both a strength and a weakness, right? When we look at it as a weakness to the industry, artificial intelligence combined with the tried and true ransomware attack mechanisms can really have an impact on an organization by speeding up the attack vectors that are present in our environments to be more successful, to drive some bypass of the human firewall, right? By emulating human beings on the other side. All that's great stuff when it's applied correctly, misused, maybe not so much, yeah. Right? Every technology seems to have a positive intent, but every technology we see throughout human history, great example being nuclear, also has a downside, a negative side to it. So AI, as far as a shift in technology, can have that negative impact. But on the positive side, right, we apply AI in things like monitoring, where we are using AI to identify attack patterns more quickly than a human being could ever do so, and more accurately, and drive defensive controls against that, perhaps through segmentation or other things in the environment. A lot of your endpoint detection and response services are driven by AI simply because we need the speed and capacity of AI to make them effective. So those endpoint detection controls, spectacular, great application of AI, and that's a good positive impact from the technology perspective.
Absolutely, couldn't agree more in terms of the strengths and the weaknesses, the fact that we sometimes forget that, yeah, the bad guys can use this, but we can as well, and it's a very powerful tool in that respect. So as we look ahead here, Scott, a little bit in the near term, what are some of the bigger trends that you see coming down the pike or things that we should be aware of?
Yeah, so I think one of those is the intersection of AI and ransomware in over the next 12 to 18 months is going to have a fundamental shift for us in the speed and accuracy of that. 15, 20 years ago when we were dealing with hacking, it was low and slow. It was not necessarily focused on organizations that did good in the world, right? You saw a lot of, right? Hackers didn't necessarily attack not-for-profits that were, helping crippled children, for example, right? They were kind of civilians in the discussion. They were left out of the plan of battle. All those lines are blurred and gone today. The speed is so much faster. The lines between that would have kept many organizations out of the fray are gone as well. I think that's I think that's important to note that that will continue over the next few years. A lot greater focus on, especially in critical infrastructure, persistent threats, right? It's no longer necessarily a requirement to go in and immediately take over and to own the organization for ransomware and others, right? You're seeing a continuation of the concept of feeding off the land, getting into an organization and using the systems, the command and control systems within that organization, RDP type sessions, administrative access, and other tool sets that are provided by the organization against the organization themselves within the environment. So I think those are some incredible changes we'll see over the next, that will accelerate over the next 24 months. I think another one that probably doesn't get the attention that it needs is one of data privacy. I think we've become numb to with the huge breaches that have been present over the last several years. It no longer surprises us when 10 million records are breached at an organization.
You know, I'm glad you brought up those living off the land or those dwelling attacks, because I agree with you. I think those are going to continue to be a bigger and bigger issue just because there's so many more hiding spots in the OT landscape right now. And as that expands, I think those are going to continue to be big challenges for OT security.
Yeah, I think they will be as well. You know, Purdue was a great model back in the day. Again, it needs to shift and take into account the changes in our landscapes. But zero trust has gained a lot of traction in the environments that we're seeing out there. At least as a goal, not necessarily as a complete implementation. But this underscores the need to avoid trusting even my administrative access controls, my administrative systems, so that if I do have a breach, somebody is feeding off my administrative landscape to move laterally within the organization, that I have an opportunity to find them. And it also underscores the need to educate and to ensure that my administrators in this environment are aware of their responsibilities in protecting these systems, reporting breaches, reporting suspicious activity, even on the systems that keep us secure. I can't tell you the number of organizations I've worked with where we're evaluating security in the organization only to find that things like the vulnerability management system is probably the easiest way to break into the organization, because they've distributed, 5,000, administrator passwords in the organization, all set to password one. It's a real problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just looking at that Unitronics PLC hack and everything that hopefully taught us in terms of changing some of those admin passwords, and that's not the only one, but there's been a lot of those.
It is absolutely an ongoing battle, but you see the industry, the PLC manufacturers, RTU, and other technology organizations that contribute in this field really becoming attuned to the need to patch and provide configuration guidance and so on for these systems. I've been very impressed over the last several years of research and working in this space as to how far the manufacturers have come. And of course, you have the traditional IT side, where the IT side is now pushing into that space. If we talk about privileged access management, right, the Beyond Trust, the CyberArks, the Centrifies, the Delinias are starting to really apply their tool sets in the OT environment. And at the same time, you have the Dark Traces and others within the OT specific environment driving to the IT side. So you have this convergence of technology. It's really a dynamic space right now. So I'm encouraged by all that.
Thanks, Scott. For more information on the work Scott and his colleagues are doing, you can check him out at aprio.com. That's APRIO.com. Also like to thank you for joining us today. And to catch up on past episodes, you can go to manufacturing.net, IEN.com, or MBTMag.com. You can also check Security Breach Hell wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple, Amazon, and Overcast. And if you have a cybersecurity story or topic that you'd like to have us explore in Security Breach, you can reach me at jeff@ien.com. For Scott Saris, I'm Jeff Ranke, and this is Security Breach.